This morning I'd like to address the matter of the Lord's Supper in the church. At least that's the title of the lesson. And as the title would suggest, I'd like to explore the relationship between the Lord's Supper and the church. And in what I'm about to say, I don't want to get the impression or leave the impression by the way I say it or by what I say that I'm unsympathetic with those of you who may have had different thoughts about this matter in the past. As a matter of fact, I said some things, taught some things, argued some things, practiced some things that are contrary to what I'm about to tell you. But in order to impress you with the practical importance of this lesson and the title, The Lord's Supper in the Church, might sound kind of dry and might indicate that the lesson is going to be kind of dry. But in order to impress you with the very practical importance of this lesson and the matters that we'll consider within it, let me ask just a few questions. And I think you'll see from them that this is a very practical, very relevant lesson. Not long after I had started preaching, I was reading in a journal and saw a report that brethren in Africa, and I can't remember which part of Africa, but brethren in Africa were having difficulty obtaining grape juice to partake of the Lord's Supper. And as a matter of fact, some had become so desperate to be able to partake of the Lord's Supper that they found a substitute for grape juice. The report was some brethren were actually resorting to using grape soda in the Lord's Supper. Of course, grape soda has no grape in it. Typically, if you read the can, some might say 1% juice or something like that. But grape soda is artificial, it's chemical, made to taste like fizzy grape juice, but it's not. My question about this would be, what would you have recommended to brethren in a situation like that? It's not altogether inconceivable that brethren could sometimes, perhaps by virtue of being in a remote place, find themselves unable to obtain grape juice for the Lord's Supper. Or if not grape juice, maybe not be able to find unleavened bread. Now, you can find regular bread, it seems like, just about all over the place. But unleavened bread? So it's not inconceivable, is it, that a situation like that might arise? What would you recommend to brethren who might find themselves in a situation like this? You might say, well, you need to plan ahead of time and be prepared. Yes, of course, that's right. But what if it's just not available in their vicinity? What would you recommend that they do? Find the closest thing to grape juice and unleavened bread? I won't answer that right now. Here's another question. What if a person is sick? Okay, here's something that strikes closer to home. You ever been so sick that you couldn't attend the Sunday assemblies? What should you do about the Lord's Supper? Should you partake of it at home? You know, I was sick a few weeks ago and unable to attend the Sunday morning assembly where the Lord's Supper was served. What should I have done? Actually, I kind of got up and close to Jerry. I don't want to say I got up in his face a while ago. A few weeks ago. And I asked Jerry, Jerry, when you were in the hospital sick years ago, and you were in the hospital over Sunday, did you partake of the Lord's Supper? I asked him some question to that effect. And again, I was trying to highlight the relevancy and the practicality of what we're going to be considering this morning. But the question would be, you know, what if you're sick? Typically, when we're so sick that we can't attend the assemblies of the church on Sunday, that doesn't mean we're so sick that we couldn't take a little thimbleful of grape juice and eat a little piece of unleavened bread. We could probably at least sit up in bed and do that much. So should we partake of it at home? That's a situation that arises that's not that unusual, is it? we could ask the question, why do we gather on Sunday? What brings us here? Why couldn't we just meet on another day of the week or not meet every week, every Sunday for that matter? What is it that brings us here on Sunday? It necessitates us meeting here on Sunday. So I ask these three questions again, and I hope that I will answer all of them in one way or another in the course of the lesson. But I ask these three questions at the beginning again to assure you and to convince you that what we're going to be considering this morning surely is very practical. Okay. At this point, let me ask this question. Under what circumstances may a person deviate from or change or modify God's instructions or His pattern for our activities? When are we not obligated to do something God said? Is what I'm basically asking. Now, of course, a quick and really somewhat oversimplified answer to that question would be, well, a person is justified in not doing what God says when he has no other choice. That's really another way of saying when a person is not physically or morally able to do what God says, then he's not disobedient if he doesn't do it. God doesn't expect you to lie, for instance, to fulfill some commandment of His. If you're going down the road and you come upon an accident and you feel like you have a moral obligation to stop and render first aid to the victims in the accident, it may be morally impossible because you have this superior moral obligation to aid your fellow man in those circumstances. You may have a moral obligation to stop and aid the victims of the accident, even if it means missing the assemblies of God's people. You may be physically unable to do so, as in the case of sickness. As a matter of fact, that would be the classic example. One is not required to meet with the church on the first day of the week or Sunday when he is sick or otherwise unable to do so. In Acts 27, Paul was on a ship in a storm for at least 14 days. That was over at least two Sundays. And there's no indication that he partook of the Lord's Supper or that he met with a church there in that ship in a storm. So situations like that can certainly arise when you're simply unable. Paul was a prisoner, too, on that occasion. You're simply unable to meet with the church as God has taught and commanded in His Word. But we don't have to reason to that position by logical inference. We can also see that there are examples of this sort of thing. Jesus Himself contemplated situations when we might not have the obligation to do what God said, you know, not to do. For instance, God had told the Israelites, you know, don't do any work on the Sabbath day. That's how they kept the Sabbath, by refraining from all labor. But the Sabbath did not forbid necessary labor. There were some exceptions to that. When you could deviate from what you would otherwise do, or in this case, not do. For instance, in Luke 13, verses 14 and 15 and 16, Jesus is confronted there, more or less confronted, criticized, at least implicitly, because he had healed, that is, worked on the Sabbath day. And he argues there, well, there's an exception to that. There are exceptions to not working on the Sabbath day. He says in verse 15, "You hypocrites! Does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead him away to water him so you can take care of your livestock?" Give minimal care, at least, to your livestock on the Sabbath day. Now, some Jews could say that was work, but they did that. So that was an exception, wasn't it? Circumstances changed. And in verse 16, he also seems to give another reason. When you need to nurse or tend to the sick or infirm, you can do so on the Sabbath day. He says, "And this woman, the daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound for 18 long years, should she not have been released from this bond on the Sabbath day?" So you can work on the Sabbath day if you need to do so in order to tend to the needs of those who are infirm. Perhaps the outstanding example of this is that of the... Before I give the outstanding example, I've got Matthew 12, verse 5 here, but Jesus said the priest in the temple said they break the Sabbath. That was the expression he used. They break this Sabbath, but we're innocent in doing so. What did he mean by that? Well, the priest had to offer sacrifices or do other special activities that God had prescribed on the Sabbath day. So the priest in the temple were actually working on the Sabbath day. What I call the primary example is in John 7. And here Jesus mentions that, or at least implies, that the eighth day, when the law of Moses prescribed that a male child had to be circumcised, might actually fall on the seventh day of the week or of the Sabbath. Does circumcision work? Well, could be considered work. Well, what do you do then? Do you circumcise your son in obedience to God's commandment, thus working, if that eighth day of his life, the day of his circumcision, happens to fall on the Sabbath day? Let's read verses 22 and 23 of John 7. He says, "But on this account, Moses has given you circumcision, not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because I've made an entire man well on the Sabbath?" So Jesus cites another reason when work can be done on the Sabbath. So there are situations in which, circumstances under which, we may deviate from God's commandment. There may be a conflict in God's commandments, and we won't go into how we know which one we ought to go with, but circumstances would indicate that we have to choose to obey one and not the other. Sometimes that happens. Yet, some claim that there might be another determinative factor in this. And what they say basically is, the ends justifies the means. If you can't do all of it, all of what God says, then pick out what you think is the most important part and do that part, even though it's a violation of the other part of the pattern. And this is where we're coming down more directly to the Lord's Supper. So they would say there's this greater good, that part of the pattern that must be done. And you've got to do it even if it involves violating other aspects or parts of the pattern. Now, let me start off with some simpler examples. Some that I don't think Christians would have that much difficulty with, if any. A couple of examples. What if you can't immerse a person? Can you substitute pouring water on them or sprinkling water on them? Actually, what most people may not recognize is that sprinkling didn't actually start with babies. It started when it was called clinical baptism. The word clinical coming from the Greek word for bed, kline. And it was called clinical baptism because in the cases of those who were on their sick beds or upon even their death beds, it was thought that since they can't, at least not very easily or practically, be brought to the water and be immersed, then, well, they've got to be baptized and they'll be about to die. Well, in that case, of course, it's confusion of words here, but they would bring the water to the person and pour it over that person in his bed or sprinkle it on him in his bed as a substitute for immersion. I've actually been in a situation like that before. And since I've been here in Piscataway, I was trying to teach a woman in a nursing home and she might have been receptive to baptism, and yet she was wheelchair bound, and it would have taken some sort of sling to let her down into the water. And I had difficulty with, she didn't seem to be that enthusiastic about being baptized to begin with. She wasn't, certainly wasn't insistent. But also had problems with the management of the nursing home where she lived. They didn't want to really cooperate in using this sling and lowering her down to the water and me baptizing her, because she just was not able to get down into the water unassisted. She actually had to be let down in some sort of sling, mechanical device. So I've actually encountered a situation. What do you do in a situation like that? May we substitute sprinkling or pouring? Well, no, I don't think you would have a problem with it. No, you can't. I don't think you would have a problem with that, would you? Well, let me bring up another one that I have already brought. What about substituting other elements for the Lord's Supper when the grape juice and the unleavened bread prescribed in the New Testament are not available? But what do you do in a situation like that? I'm hoping you wouldn't have a problem. I wouldn't have a problem answering this. You just don't partake of it. If you can't, you can't. And don't feel bad about it. And that's the point, the basic point. If you can't do what God says in the way that He says to do it, then you're not obligated to do it. It's really as simple as that. Although sometimes we feel guilty about it. Well, let me bring up more directly the Lord's Supper. And look at some aspects of it or its pattern in the New Testament, the pattern for partaking of it, that we are fuzzy about in our thinking. And really, brethren have been, in my experience, all over the map about this. And I don't mean to be overly critical about this, because I have been one of them. I have not been consistent about this in the past. In more recent years, I have tried to be more consistent. But this inconsistency on the part of the brethren extends to the setting for the Lord's Supper, or where we partake of it, the place where we partake of it. Let me give you some examples of how brethren are don't really have clear thinking about this, it seems to me. They're not consistent about it. And I think it's because we haven't studied it thoroughly enough, we haven't looked at the Scriptures carefully enough, and been as conscientious about this as perhaps we should have. And that's why I'm presenting this lesson. I want us to be clearer about these matters. For instance, I think I'm behind as far as my PowerPoint is concerned. Maybe I'm not. The inconsistency is that they will insist on some parts of the pattern, but not insist on others. For instance, okay, now I know where I am. I'm able to match up my PowerPoint with my notes here. I got confused there for a moment. For instance, they will correctly insist that we used grape juice and unleavened bread. Okay, we're clear about that. If you don't have the grape juice and the unleavened bread, then you just don't partake of the Lord's Supper. They would be also correct about eating it on the first day of the week. They would not say, well, since we don't have grape juice and unleavened bread here today, let's just shift the Lord's Supper to Wednesday or some other day of the week. No, if we can't do it on the first day of the week, we don't do it. Acts 20 and verse 7. Now, there are some areas, particularly regarding the setting or the place that we do it, brethren are not consistent. They insist on some parts of the pattern, but not on other parts of the pattern. For instance, some eat of it when they cannot partake of it with the church. They would say, well, you know, if you can't partake of it in the church, you know, good and fine, but if you can't, then you don't have to. And I have been known in the past, distant past, decades ago, I've actually taken the Lord's Supper to people in nursing homes or to people in the hospital, and they have served it to them. We've really been kind of inconsistent about that, though, because if people tend to be sick at home on Sunday, we don't necessarily see to it that they get the Lord's Supper when they're sick at home. But if they're sick in the hospital, for some reason, that seems to make a difference. I don't know why, but that's what I'm talking about. There's really been some fuzzy thinking about this. And there are some variations of partaking of it. Some think they should partake in the church, but not with the church. This would be the so-called second serving. Particularly in those churches that also have an assembly on Sunday night, they will serve to those who, for whatever reason, weren't there Sunday morning to partake of the Lord's Supper. They will serve it to them on Sunday night. When we had two assemblies here at Piscataway years ago now, a couple of decades ago, we used to do that. Other churches still do that. And so, brethren, a few in the congregation will partake in the assembly or in the church, but of course the others don't partake with them. So they partake in the church, but not with the church. Which might lead someone to ask, well, if they don't have to partake with the church, why don't they just partake at home before they come? I don't know that they would say this, but sometimes it seems like it gets down to this. In the meeting house, but not in the church. I remember as a youth one time, if memory serves, I was in a situation myself where it seems like I was not there on Sunday morning, but I was away from home and I met with another church and I was not there in the assembly on Sunday morning. Sunday night, I wanted to partake of the Lord's Supper, and there were others, and they sent us off to an adjoining room. I think they dismissed the rest of the congregation, and they said something like, those of you who didn't get the Lord's Supper this morning and want it tonight, there's a room back here where you will be served. And so So some people seem to think you need to come to the meeting house and be in the church building where you can partake of it, but don't necessarily have to be in the church. That is, the congregation will have been dismissed. Some will partake of it. This is similar to the last point. Maybe they think they need to be served by members of the church. They need to be served the Lord's Supper by members of the church. Otherwise, I would wonder, if you want to partake of the Lord's Supper, why not just partake of it by yourself at home, if you're by yourself, or at least with your family, either, you know, before the assemblies or after the assemblies. You know, why would you need to come to the church building at all and be served by other brethren? Couldn't you serve yourself? So this tends to happen when the Lord's Supper is taken to brethren in the hospital or brethren in nursing homes, and you could wonder, well, couldn't they just serve themselves? Do they need to be served by members of the church? I don't think that they have thought this through, but some seem to have that impression. And sometimes here's what I think is the granddaddy of them all. As far as inconsistencies are concerned. Some will make sure that they have the Lord's Supper when they're traveling, and they don't have a church nearby that they can attend. So they will make arrangements for themselves to have it while they're traveling. But when they're sick, you know, I almost never hear of anybody making sure that they get the Lord's Supper when they're sick at home on Sunday. I don't know that I've ever heard of that. Well, I probably have heard of it, but I've never done that. I've taken it to hospitals and nursing homes, but I don't think anybody's home. Though I think I have heard of some brethren doing that. It seems to be that when brethren are sick at home, they don't feel an obligation to partake of the Lord's Supper. But if they're off traveling somewhere and don't have access to a local church with which they can meet, then they will brown bag the Lord's Supper. Take it with them. I've heard of that. Jerry, for instance, was telling me, I think Friday or Saturday, and I'm not picking on Jerry for his examples, because I've heard of this same thing. It's really not that unusual. He was telling me that in Spain, he had problems with brethren during their summer vacations because they would want to brown bag the Lord's Supper and take it with them on vacation and just skip going to church while they were on vacation. But they had the Lord's Supper with them. That's okay. I have heard of brethren maybe who have gone on cruises. And they're not going to be able to meet with the church while they're on the cruise. And well, they brown bag the Lord's Supper, just take it with them so they'll have it. There was one occasion when I got a call from, he's probably a nationally known, I'm sure he's a nationally known preacher. And I got a call from him some years ago while I was here in Piscataway. And he was asking me about the churches in the New York City area, because he and some other brethren in his group had an occasion, and I can understand how he would be excited about this, but he was a member of a singing group. And he and his group had been invited to sing at Carnegie Hall. How exciting. Problem was, I think they were going to be singing there on Sunday afternoon. It was on a Sunday anyway. So anyway, he wanted to know where they could meet with a church while they were in New York City. And I think I directed them to the church in Brooklyn. That might have been at that time the closest congregation I could direct them to. Not long after that, I saw a member of the Brooklyn church. And I said, "Hey, did Brother so-and-so get in touch with you, and did he attend with you?" She said, no, he called and said that they weren't going to be able to make it, so they were just going to partake of the Lord's Supper in their motel room and then head off to Carnegie Hall. So that's what brethren do sometimes. In lieu of meeting with the church, they will just take up the Lord's Supper in their motel room or whatever, or in some sort of similar situation. Okay. Well, let me give you a couple of helpful principles about all of this. The first of these two principles that I think will help us to make judgments about this is that God does not want us to approximate obedience. God doesn't say, if you can't do what I say, then do the next best thing or do the closest thing. God doesn't want you just to get close. Either you do it or you don't do it. And if it's really the case that you can't do it, then don't do it. Don't try to do just part of what God said if you can't do all of what He said. If you're referring to a particular practice, that is. And now the example I have for this is that of Micah, a fellow by the name of Micah in Judges, the 17th chapter. Now, Micah was an idolater among the Israelites. And in the story of Micah, he makes this ephod and he has a graven image. And he uses all of this paraphernalia in idolatry. And he even sets up one of his sons as his priest. Now, Micah and his sons are not descendants of Aaron, and of course, only descendants of Aaron could be priests according to the law of Moses. It says in verse 5, "And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols, and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest." Now, they were Ephraimites, apparently. They were living in the hill country of Ephraim, so apparently they were Ephraimites. And he makes one of his sons a priest. Well, not only is an idolater, but he's violating the law of Moses in that he makes someone who's not entitled to the priesthood a priest. But then along comes this young man, according to verse 7, who is a Levite. And to make a long story short, Micah makes him his priest. But notice particularly what Micah says in verse 13. "Then Micah said, 'Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as a priest.'" The problem was that not all of the Levites were descendants of Aaron and thus qualified to be priests either. The term Levite is used to refer to those descendants of Levi outside the family of Aaron. So, this young man who was a Levite was not qualified either to be a priest. So what makes Micah happy about this? Micah is happy because at least he's gotten closer to what the law of Moses prescribed. At least he's gotten into the right tribe, Levi, if not family, descendants of Aaron. So what he's actually saying here is, the Lord will like me more, will bless me, will cause me to prosper, because I have gotten closer to doing what His Word says. That wasn't good enough. That wasn't good enough. So again, God does not expect us or want us simply to approximate His pattern. If we can do it all fine, then do it. If we can't, then don't do it. It's not enough just to get close. That's the first principle. The other principle is this. When one cannot do what God says, then he should not do it at all. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 13 for this. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, King Saul and his forces are about to be attacked by the Philistines. And the Philistines are numerous. And so a battle seems to be imminent. And before King Saul goes into battle, he wants to offer a sacrifice and ask the blessing of the Lord in the forthcoming battle. The problem was that back in 1 Samuel 10 verse 8, the prophet and judge Samuel had told him, "Wait for me to come and offer the sacrifice in 7 days at Gilgal." So here was the pattern. Gilgal, 7 days, I'll offer the sacrifice. Those were the stipulations in this God's instructions, the pattern. Well, here this battle is imminent. And Samuel hasn't offered sacrifice or asked the blessing of the Lord. Or Saul hasn't. And Samuel hasn't shown up. And it seems like he's not going to. And let's look at what happens here. Beginning in verse 8 of 1 Samuel 13. Now he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. Stop. This is how bad it's getting. The people are trembling. They're afraid of the Philistine attack, which seems to be imminent. And some are deserting Saul. Saul's in a precarious situation. What is he to do? Well, let's read on. So Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering, And it came about as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering that, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. But Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, therefore I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord.' So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." Let's stop there just a moment. Saul's under great pressure. He's about to be attacked. He hasn't asked the favor of the Lord with this sacrifice. Samuel hasn't shown up. The people are scattering. The Philistines are about to attack. It's no wonder that he says, "I forced myself." What is he saying there? I have no choice. I was absolutely desperate. I had to do this. Even though it was contrary to your instructions, I had to do it. Does that satisfy Samuel? Look in verse 13. "And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever.'" And reading on into verse 14, "But now your kingdom shall not endure." Now, in a nutshell, what lesson do we learn from that? Always do what the Lord said, even when you're in desperate circumstances and you feel pressure. Saul lost his kingdom over this. Okay, now let's apply these two principles to the setting for the Lord's Supper, which is, to put it in a nutshell, the assembly of the local church. Scripture shows a consistent pattern of local churches as a setting for the Lord's Supper. I want to show three scriptures to that effect. The primary one would be 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter. 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter. In 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, the last half of that chapter, anyway, Paul corrects two abuses of the Lord's Supper on the part of the Corinthian church. First of all, as we see in verses 23-22, and also verse 34, the Corinthians had turned the Lord's Supper into a common meal. And Paul says, why do you not have houses in which to eat and drink? And he says in verse 34, if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home. So apparently they had turned the Lord's Supper into some sort of banquet. At least some of them did. And Paul corrects that. He says, this is a memorial meal. And he points out that Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me. This is not a common meal designed to satisfy your bodily hunger. No. This is a memorial meal. And so if you want a meal that satisfies your hunger, where do you eat that? He says, do that at home. When you come here, it's to eat the Lord's Supper, which is a memorial meal, not a common meal. So that's how it corrects that problem. The other problem that they had was that they were not eating the Lord's Supper together. I'm not sure that I know exactly what the scenario was, but maybe the rich among them were getting off to one side and ignoring the poor among them, the slaves among them. And they were having their own banquet and eating the Lord's, what they call the Lord's Supper. And that's understandable why they would do something like this, because in idols' temples, that's what they did. They feasted. And they had that kind of, that's the kind of background that they came out of. So they would think, you might say naturally, well, the Lord's Supper is kind of a banquet. And they just ignored the poor and they got among themselves perhaps the rich and the elite and they ate the Lord's Supper, what they thought was the Lord's Supper, without the others. Paul says, what you're doing is not really the Lord's Supper. And he points out that one of the problems is that you're not eating together. And he corrects this problem by saying, wait for one another. Don't get ahead of one another. Don't go off to the side, ahead of somebody else, ahead of the others, and eat the Lord's Supper with your group or clique. This is a together activity. Everybody engages in it together. So, this Paul's statement, wait for one another, in verse 33, implies they were supposed to eat the Lord's Supper together. If they didn't have to eat the Lord's Supper together, what was the point in waiting for one another? Paul says in verse 21, particularly, describing the sorry situation there at Corinth, he says at the end of verse 21, and one is hungry and another is drunk. The reason I read that is because some may have the idea that some of the Corinthians jumped the gun and they ate the Lord's Supper prematurely before the scheduled time. And that was not the problem. No. How do we know that? Because Paul said at the end of verse 21, for one is hungry and another is drunk. He does not say one is absent and another is drunk. The very fact that he observes that one was hungry infers that he was there, the one who was hungry was there. Otherwise, how would you know he was hungry? He was there, he just wasn't eating with the one who is described as drunk. And this word drunk, by the way, may not mean intoxicated. It may mean filled or sated with food or drink. So, he's not saying one is absent and another is drunk. They were there. It's just that they weren't eating the Lord's Supper together. Some were eating it, some were not. And as a matter of fact, four times, or no less than four times in this long dissertation on the Lord's Supper, verses 17 through 34, 1 Corinthians 11, four times Paul uses the word together. This was something that was a together activity, not something that they were to do separately. In verses 17 and 18, for instance, he says, "For in giving this instruction, I do not praise you because you come together, not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that divisions exist among you, and in part I believe it. And then also, in verse 20, he says, therefore, when you meet together, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. In verse 33, so then, my brethren, when you come together to eat, wait for one another." So he says, together, 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 together. And the problem was that when they came together to, and they were supposed to be eating the Lord's Supper together, they weren't doing that. And Paul corrects that by saying, wait for one another, which infers, don't get ahead of one another. Do it at the same time. Do it together. Okay, let's look at that other passage. In Acts 2, verses 42 through 44. What I want us to see is that there is a consistent pattern of brethren partaking of the Lord's Supper together. The members of the church got together to partake of the Lord's Supper. They didn't do so in their private homes or in other exclusive private settings. In Acts 2, verse 42, it says, "And they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayer." These are four things that they were devoting themselves to continually, it says. The word devoting, continually devoting, is from the Greek word proskatereo. Now, in verse 42, what did they... It occurs twice in this fairly tight context. In verse 42 and then again in verse 46. Its occurrence in verse 42 tells us what they were devoting themselves to. Well, there are four things. They're specified as the apostles' teaching, second, fellowship, third, the breaking of bread, and fourth, prayer. By the way, the definite article "the" is used in front of each of these four items. It was not just any breaking of bread, it was the breaking of bread. It was the prayer. It was the prayers they offered together at the temple, which brings up verse 46, where the other occasion of the use of this Greek word translated continually or devoting continually is used or occurs. So that we're told what they were devoting themselves to in verse 42. Verse 46, where this word occurs again, tells us where they were devoting themselves to it. It says in verse 46, "And day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart." Now, the phrase "breaking the bread" is a generic expression in and of itself, which refers to any breaking of bread. It can refer to common meals. It can also refer to the Lord's Supper. How do we know which is which? Particularly in verse 46. In verse 46, we know the breaking of bread there was common meals. How do we know that? Because it actually says that. It says that breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals or food together with gladness and sincerity of heart. But it also says at the beginning of verse 46 that day by day they were continuing with one mind in the temple. So every day they were gathering together to devote themselves to one. Not necessarily the Lord's Supper, but at least every day they got together to hear the apostles' teaching. They would pray, because there are other things we can do on other days of the week, such as praying or teaching. But verse 42 tells us what they were doing. Verse 46 says where they were doing it. In other words, there was a place large enough to accommodate all of them where they could get together and do these things. Namely, the temple. In chapter 5, verse 12, it was that part of the temple area called Solomon's Porch or Portico, which could, well, it could accommodate thousands of people. So, they would get together in the temple to partake of the Lord's Supper, as we know from Acts 20, verse 7, on the first day of the week, together. And also other activities such as hearing the apostles teach on other days of the week. But they dispersed to their homes to eat their meals with one another. The Lord's Supper, to which they were continually devoting themselves, took place where? Not in their private homes, but where? In a place that could accommodate all of them. That is, the temple area. The third passage I would like to look at is in Acts 20 and verse 7. And that does not really require much comment, because it just comes right out and says that they came together to break bread. Let me just read the verse. I think that's about all that would be required. Acts 20 and verse 7. And on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to depart the next day, and he prolonged his message until midnight. So Luke says, we were gathered together to break bread, that is, partake of the Lord's Supper. So we see a consistent pattern here. 1 Corinthians 11, Acts 2, and Acts 20, there's a consistent pattern of brethren, members of a local church, getting together with one another to partake of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. There is not one exception to that. That is the pattern. Now, may we deviate from that pattern? No. No, we may not. If we want to partake of the Lord's Supper, we need to do so with our brethren on the first day of the week as the church is assembled. If you cannot do that, if you're sick or you have to work or you have some other legitimate reason why you cannot make it to the assemblies of the Lord's church on Sunday, if you are excused from the assemblies, if you think you're excused from the assemblies, you're excused from partaking of the Lord's Supper. You don't have to single out the Lord's Supper and say, this is something I have to do under other circumstances, namely at home or whatever. No. If you can't make it, you can't make it, and you're excused. And you don't have to feel guilty about that. I'll come back to that in just a moment, but let me move on right now and ask this question. And this will be, I suppose, the last question of the lesson. And I want to give three answers to it. Why is the local church as the setting for the Lord's Supper so important? Why make a big deal out of this? Why insist that if you partake of the Lord's Supper, it needs to be within the context of the assembled local church partaking with you? Why? Three answers. The first one is very short. That's where God placed it. And for the man or woman of faith, that's really all that needs to be said. If God put it there, that's where we need to keep it. But I think we can consider some other reasons that appear rather obvious. And the second one is this. It fulfills, putting it in the context of the local church, fulfills its, the Lord's Supper's purpose as a public proclamation of Christ's death. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 11, verse 26. And we note there that Paul says, for as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until He comes. Now, focus in on the word proclaim. And I don't have the time right now to take us through a word study here, but this word proclaim, in the Greek anyway, occurs 11 times in the New Testament. And in every one of those times, it refers not to private teaching, but to some sort of preaching or public proclamation. You can see that I thought I had given a couple of examples here. Yes, I do. In Acts 4, verses 1 and 2, I believe, the apostles there are spoken of as proclaiming Christ in the temple, a public area. In Philippians 1, verses 15 through 17, the terms preaching and proclamation are used interchangeably, which gives a practical definition to proclamation as preaching. This word, which Paul uses in reference to the Lord's Supper, 1 Corinthians 11:26, refers to a public proclamation. Well, the word proclamation means that. You don't get in your bedroom or your living room and proclaim anything. Proclamation is, by its very nature, something that is public. So what I'm simply trying to say here is that the Lord's Supper is a public memorial. It was intended to say publicly, we are remembering. We're doing this because of this reason, because Jesus Christ died for us. We're remembering that. And in 14, verses 23 through 25, Paul contemplates a situation there where unbelievers can come and enter. Now, we have a public assembly here in that members of the public are invited to come in and at least observe and sit and watch. They almost never do that, but it has happened, and they're allowed to do that. We invite members of the public. In that sense, our assembly here is public. And Paul contemplates that situation in 1 Corinthians 14. Unbelievers could come in, see what's going on. They might be convinced of the truth by listening and observing. So in that sense, when we partake of the Lord's Supper, we're saying, before anybody who cares to observe, before any other member of the public who cares to come in and see what we're doing, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it. Which is why, by the way, we need at least a brief explanation of what's going on when we partake of the cup and the bread. So, why is the Lord's Supper set in the context of the assembled local church? Instead of your bedroom, your closet, your living room, your motel room. Because Paul said it's supposed to be a proclamation of the Lord's death. Last answer to the question. Why is the local church the setting for the Lord's Supper? Why is that so important? Because this preserves the local church. This gets back to the question I asked at the beginning of the lesson. Why are we here on Sunday? Why couldn't we just say, I'm going to partake of the Lord's Supper with my family or by myself in my home and just skip going to church? Why are we here on Sunday? Why is Sunday the day to go to church? This is so important because if we don't nail this down, we're not going to have a reason in the Bible for being here on Sunday. If the Lord's Supper does not require the church to assemble on Sunday to partake of it, then there is nothing which does require them to assemble. Does it require them to assemble weekly? Certainly not. Not even necessarily frequently or regularly. If you tell me, if someone tells us that we don't have to meet here every Sunday to partake of the Lord's Supper, then what in the New Testament does require us to meet here? We can pray at other times. We could give of our earnings from our homes. We could say, Jerry, you stop by our home on Sunday and pick up my contribution. We don't have to assemble for the contribution. We can have teaching in our homes, and sometimes we do. We can have singing in our homes, and sometimes we do. So what is it that requires us to come here on Sunday? Acts 20 and verse 7, on the first day of the week when we were gathered together to break bread. That is, partake of the Lord's Supper. It's the Lord's Supper. If you knock that prop out, then you knock out what requires God's people in a local church to assemble every Sunday to partake of the Lord's Supper. It will destroy the church if we don't recognize this. If you don't think, where are most people, you think, right now? You think most people out there in our communities are in church right now? Are they off doing something else, somewhere else? I ask that because it doesn't take much to convince people they don't have to go to church on Sunday. That's why I say, if we don't understand this, if we don't nail this down and have our minds clear about the New Testament teaching on this point, it will destroy the church. Already, I know for a fact, because I've discussed it with a brother, we have brethren who are going around and saying, no, the New Testament does not teach that we have to assemble to partake of the Lord's Supper on Sunday. This is a very practical problem. Now, some may argue that if it is not possible to eat the Lord's Supper in the assembly of a church, then it may be eaten outside. So actually what they're doing is they're just throwing away the pattern. But they will say, if you're in a crunch, then you can go ahead and partake of the Lord's Supper outside the church. Well, in the first place, this reasoning is nowhere articulated in the New Testament. It's just not stated. The New Testament nowhere says that if we can't make it to an assembly of the Lord's church on Sunday to partake of the Lord's Supper, then we can do it outside. That's nowhere in the New Testament. That's made out of whole cloth. That's a fabrication if I've ever seen one. But beyond that, this kind of reasoning encourages abuse of the Lord's Supper. How does it do that? Because once you tell brethren, you know, you don't really have to go to church to partake of the Lord's Supper. If you can't, then you can partake of it outside. Then brethren are going to, and this has been done, brethren will arbitrarily and subjectively decide when they can't make it to church. And they will soothe their consciences by saying, well, at least I took the Lord's Supper with me. I brown bagged the grape juice and the bread, and I took it with me on vacation or on my cruise or, you know, when I went to the ballpark or whatever. And they'll find reasons like that for doing that. They will abuse that. I can guarantee that because I have seen it done. Well, what about our need to go camping? Well, there's no church nearby. I mean, the closest church is 40 to 50 miles away. You don't expect us to leave the campground to partake of the Lord's Supper. I tell you what, we can do what's equivalent. We can just take the Lord's Supper with it and we'll have it in our tent. Won't even have to leave the campground and drive 40 to 50 miles to be with God's people. But the question would be, if they can substitute for one part of God's pattern, then why can they not substitute for any part, such as the elements or the day? There's no middle ground that exists here. Either the New Testament teaches that the Lord suffers to be eaten in the local church, or it does not teach that. And if it doesn't teach that, then we cannot impose that stipulation on people. And we can just stay home on Sunday and have the Lord's Supper. Alone or with our families. The New Testament simply does not say or infer that the Lord's Supper may be eaten in another setting. Now, the one who claims that Christians may eat the Lord's Supper outside a church when they cannot eat it with a church, what's that person really saying? A person is really saying that they do not have to eat it in the assembly of the church, period. That's what that person is really, in effect, saying. The New Testament simply does not give any alternative position. Any fallback position? Any provisional place for the Lord's Supper outside a church assembly? It's there or it's nowhere, according to what the New Testament says. And once a person says that he may partake of the Lord's Supper outside a church, then he may arbitrarily decide not to assemble with a church to partake of the Lord's Supper for any variety of arbitrary reasons. And if I were to get in his face, maybe I shouldn't use that expression, but if I were to confront him and say, why weren't you here? You should have been here on Sunday to take a look. The New Testament doesn't teach that. Well, I know, but you should have been. Well, how can you impose on me something that the New Testament doesn't impose on me? So again, we come back to the point, either the New Testament teaches this is the way it is to be done, and we ought to do it that way, or not do it at all. Remember what I said, a second principle a while ago? We got from 1 Samuel 13. If you can't do something that God said the way He said to do it, then you're not obligated to do it at all. So, when one does not assemble with a church to eat the Lord's Supper, the biggest problem, the real problem here, is that he didn't assemble with the church. Some people think, oh, I didn't get the Lord's Supper. That's not the problem. The problem is you chose to do something else. When you could have been at church, you chose to do something else rather than assemble. So they don't understand what the real problem is. So when a person does not assemble with the church to eat the Lord's Supper, the biggest problem is that he didn't assemble with the church. Not that he did not eat the Lord's Supper. And that problem, not assembling with the church, is not resolved by eating the Lord's Supper outside the church. Doesn't do one thing at all to resolve the big problem, the real problem. And that is that that person didn't care to assemble with the Lord's church, or didn't make the plans, or didn't make the preparations to do so. That's the real problem. In conclusion, if Christians cannot do what God says, God does not tell them to do the next best thing or the closest thing to it. Nowhere says that. Nowhere says, for instance, if you can't baptize somebody, immerse somebody, then sprinkle somebody. Doesn't say if you can't get grape juice, then use grape soda. Doesn't say if you can't partake of the Lord's Supper inside the assemblies of a local church, then do it outside. Doesn't say that. God doesn't say, if you can't do what I said, then do the next best thing. He does not say that. With God, as in life, it is better not to do something if you can't do it the right way. Either a Christian is able to act according to all of God's pattern, and he does that, or he is excused from acting according to it at all. If you can't do what God said, if you really can't do what God said, then you're excused. And don't worry about it. What you may need to do is back up and say, was it really the case that I couldn't do what God said? Was it really the case that I couldn't make it to church? Was it the case that I didn't care? That I didn't make the plans? That I didn't build my vacation around the meeting with the local church instead of building the Lord's Supper or some of it around my vacation? I'll close with an example, a personal example if you don't mind. In 2001, my family and I went out as far west as Yellowstone National Park. And we stopped at, I think we took about 2 weeks, maybe a little bit more than 2 weeks, went out there and drove out there and drove back. And that long a trip, it took some planning. And I had to sit down and I had to look at church directories and so on and said, okay, where are there faithful churches that I can meet with along the route? And I don't want to go too far off the route. I'm going to be in this area at this time. I want to be in this area at this time. Where's the local church? You have to make those kinds of decisions. Now, why do that? Why even bother with that? Because that's my obligation to meet with God's people, to partake of the Lord's Supper, among other things, on the first day of the week. So I had to, first of all, say, this is what gets priority on my vacation. Oh, what if you can't go on vacation and meet with God's people? Well, then go someplace else on vacation. Or don't go on vacation at all. Now, there may be some exceptions to that. I understand that there may be gray areas. I had a preacher tell me one time that, it may be, it's a matter of judgment. If you go to someplace like Israel to look at the Bible lands, and there are few, if any, churches of the Lord in Israel. Actually, none that I know of personally. Well, but you want to go see where Jesus walked or whatever, and you want to increase your knowledge of the Bible by doing so, does that justify you absenting yourself from the assemblies of God's people on the first day of the week? Well, I would say that's a matter of judgment. I could say maybe a person might have a good argument in that particular case. So I don't deny that there's some gray areas and there's some questions and there's some sometimes you have to do some self-examination in reaching these sorts of decisions. But let's not use the Lord's Supper as an excuse. I mean, being able to partake of it outside the assemblies of the Lord's Church is an excuse for not doing what we really need to do, and that is give God's kingdom priority. And then build our lives around that. It may be that there is at least one person here today who perhaps has been impressed with how particular God's law can be. God's Word can be in telling us what to do. For instance, I made reference to immersion. Oh, God does not allow us to ignore that or to substitute something for that. God has told us that if we want to be saved from our sins through Jesus Christ, we need, having heard His Word, to come to believe in Him as the Son of God, repent of our sins, confess our faith in Him, and be immersed or baptized. Well, preacher, are there some exceptions or substitutions to end it up? Part of God's pattern? No, there's not. No, there's not. We're not into making substitutions here. If you want to be saved, and we hope you do, that's what you need to do to be saved. There's no other way around it, no other alternative that God provides in His Word. If you have followed that process in becoming a child of God, but since then have fallen away and wish to be renewed in your relationship with God and with His people by confession of your sins here before us today, we bid you to come forward and make your needs and desires known also as together we stand and sing.